Welcome back to The Popular Show with me, James A. Smith. I'm delighted to join someone I've interviewed a couple of times before on previous projects. First time on The Popular Show, though. This is Jack Frayne-Reed. Jack, welcome aboard.
I'm very happy to be on The Popular Show, man, as your latest right-wing guest.
That's right. Well,
here to stick it to the COVID lies, like my hero Van Morrison.
I knew that Van Morrison would be your kind of way of connecting with that part of our audience.
That's all meant in good humour, by the way. As I was just saying to James before we hit record, I'm a fan of the show and I've been especially enjoying the Palestine coverage.
Well, you've got to get it off your chest and onto other people's somehow. Jack, when the revolution has happened and the true cultural history of Corbynism comes to be written, there's going to be a chapter on you. Younger listeners listeners who came on board the Corbyn Project in 2017 won't know the real struggle period of the first couple of years of Corbynism, when Jack and his platform, The Real Politic Podcast, were a very important guiding light to a lot of us. And you also surreptitiously, I think, introduced quite a lot of the subcultural vocabulary that characterized the euphoric period of the Corbyn times around 2017.
But calling people melts and stuff, you mean?
All of that, you know, you'd made a big contribution already. I guess you were, 20 years old or something when that was going down?
I was 21 when Corbyn became leader. So, yeah. A couple of 23, I guess, when the glory days of 2017 went down.
Not too old to have the Daily Mail going through your bins, though.
And, no.
Publishing on you is a great example of Corbyn's hate mob.
Yeah, lefty hate trolls. I was accused of boasting about spreading fake news. Which was actually one of the more accurate bits of that article.
It's all relative, isn't it?
Yeah. Good times. No, very, very. It's a spooky thing having like the British media go after you. You know, it definitely puts a new perspective on things. But you know, we're all good. We're all back now. We're still here. And the Daily Mail, where are they? Who's ever heard of them?
Well, you know, it's always great to be talking to another survivor or casualty of Corbynism, but that's not what we're here to talk about. We're talking about something quite different. We are repairing our mutual reputations as some of Britain's foremost philo-Semitic podcasters by discussing a reputation that's taken a bit of a dent in recent weeks. We are talking about Bob Dylan, that other favourite topic of both of our platforms. Why on earth, Jack, do both of our politics shows keep going back to this 84-year-old guy in the year 2023?
Well, I'm part of that like rarefied breed of under 30 Bob Dylan fans, although in a few months I will be just another old git who listens to Bob Dylan.
Welcome.
But but no, I've been trying to fly that flag for basically as long as I've had a podcast, because just like the way my mind works is like, if all I'm thinking about is music, it's kind of hard for me to do an episode where we're just talking about like, oh, and then this centrist said this about Corbyn. It's like, you know, if I'm in Dylan mode, I'm all in. So yeah, we've done a few episodes covering his work, and I've enjoyed the ones that The Popular Show have done as well. I was saying to James, like, well, hey, where's my invite to talk about Bob Dylan? Like, I'm probably one of like the biggest like under 30 Bob Dylan fans in the UK.
And we finally did it. Yeah. Okay. So we've just caught you in time to have you in the flock of young Dylan commentators like
exactly.
Alison Rapp and Laura Tenshirts of the Definitely Dylan podcast. Speaking to them, it's interesting to get this perspective of Dylan fans who have mainly come to him through streaming services, whereas I had to stand in Soundhouse in Broadstairs, gazing at different plastic cases of Dylan CDs, wondering which ones were the good ones, resorting to back copies of Mojo magazine to find out if I should buy Dylan and the Dead or not. And thus, there's plenty in the Dylan catalog that I've only actually heard, you know, since streaming services have come along. There are some that I just never got around to buying. Whereas, the kids who are, let's be honest, a little younger than you, have got...
As I said, I'm an old git. Like, it's happening, man. I can feel the transformation, like, taking place.
And about, I mean, a year and a half ago, I sort of decided we'd try and do some more cultural stuff on the popular show for similar therapeutic
cultural
reasons.
Marxism.
Cultural Marxism. Yeah, I thought we'd do some cultural Marxism. Then ended up just making a bunch of shows about Dylan because, as I've said, each time he is the last really active artist of that kind of earlier high point of creativity in popular music in the early late decades of the 20th century. He is still a contemporary artist and contemporary creative, and leaves most younger people in the dust. And he just keeps doing interesting things. So if I thought, we'll do a Dylan show about the tour, about the Rough and Rowdy Ways tour coming to the UK about a year ago, but then suddenly you've got the Philosophy of Modern Song, suddenly you've got Shadow Kingdom out, the box set's based on Time Out of Mind.
Fantastic.
All of this stuff needs covering. Now, the latest is the complete Budokan, and I'm just going to fill the listeners in with Paul Williams, one of the standard authorities, from his trilogy of books, Bob Dylan, Performing Artist. Let's see what Paul Williams has to tell us to contextualize what Dylan was getting up to in the Budokan Theatre. In May 1977, Dylan signed a contract with Jerry Weintraub's management company, which also represented such mainstream show business figures as Frank Sinatra, John Denver, and Neil Diamond. The 1978 tour, his first since Rolling Thunder, was clearly planned by Dylan as a very professional affair, an opportunity to mature, to settle into the role of entertainer. Dylan assembled a new band, rehearsed for at least 6 weeks, and on February 20th, 1978, opened his world tour with a 28-song performance, well over 2 hours in length, in Tokyo, Japan.
That's fucking awesome, by the way. Like, if you go and see Bob Dylan now, he does like 17 songs. Obviously, he's 80, so I'm not saying that as a criticism, but just 28 songs, that's some good shit, man. That's a heavy chunk of the Dylan catalogue.
We've not been exposed to these monster shows live. When I saw, I'll have to look it up, but when I saw him in 2022... it wasn't a bad set. These days, it feels nicely crafted. It doesn't feel like this kind of rambling, all-encompassing kind of thing anymore. It's like seeing a great Shakespearean actor performing a role these days.
Yeah, it's very structured, whereas this is kind of like a Springsteen show, basically. He does like 28 song sets.
Yeah.
It's like, we'll give you the hits plus, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Two of the Tokyo shows were recorded by Dylan's Japanese record company, edited into a two-disc album and released under the title Bob Dylan at Budokan. Unfortunately, the 1978 tour was a slow starter and the Budokan album represents it poorly. I don't think it would be possible to put together a really first-rate album from any of the early shows, but these particular performances from February 28th and March 1st catch Dylan and his band at a low ebb. Well, now we have the chance to make up our own minds about that. Those two shows in their entirety are now available to us as what is it on discs, a four disc album.
Yeah, and then there's a condensed version that basically has, I think there's 11 songs or so, according to the great Dylan blogger Ray Padgett, that are featured on this box set that aren't featured at all on the original 78 Budokan album. But obviously there's a lot of alternate performances of the songs that were featured. So they've put out a condensed version of the record called Another Budokan that's basically just stuff that we hadn't already heard.
So the role of these releases, and there is no catalogue that has been so mined for its alternate versions, its live versions, its rarities, as Dylan's has. Among his innovations is in showing what a legacy artist can do with their back catalogue, as Dylan has been mining his since the late 1980s in these kind of background releases. One of the jobs that they have is to get us to reconsider sort of unloved parts of Dylan history. Recent bootleg series releases have shown us the kind of fuller picture of what Dylan was getting up to in his much maligned synth pop era in the late 1980s, the Christian rock era. And in a way, this is
that was 10 years ago. Sorry, that record, but
yeah, but that's another great example of the same task.
It's getting quite funny how, like, every one of these that they put out for a period that for years the received wisdom was just like, oh no, that's just shit. Every time they put it out and people are like, oh no, actually.
Wait a minute. He was right and we were wrong. There is something to that old narrative, though, because there is maybe a pattern in Dylan's career where after some height of creativity, he'll then do something that the hardcore fans regard as kind of below his dignity. Mm. The obvious early example is going electric and being called Judas by the folk fans. But even before that, another side of Bob Dylan introducing love songs into previously a kind of protest folk song catalogue was an early hint that Dylan was kind of capable of adopting this pattern. Going country is another example. Self-portraits with these kind of superly produced string laden cover versions, the Christian period, of course, covers albums in the early 90s, the Great American Songbook, something that we used to
no one saw that shit
Buble or Rod Stewart doing, and each time Dylan kind of comes out of this stooping with a conquering new creative outlook, or is able to do some new thing that you didn't know he could do before he did that. I wonder if we can sort of see the Budokan shows in that light. Here is Dylan wearing a white blazer. He's doing a kind of greatest hits Vegas style show in contrast to the Rolling Thunder Review, which was his previous tour, which was far more experimental, this kind of collaborative, ever-shifting cast of different musicians in the band, this kind of gypsy arrangement of all of his songs. This time round, we're getting very slick arrangements, very kind of commercial arrangements of all of the Dylan eras in a much more precisely calculated way than ever before.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, obviously that it's called like his Vegas period or his Neil Diamond tour or whatever. And I mean, you don't have to think that the new sound is bad, but you can't ignore it. Like, he did adopt like a big mainstream sound. Like, you have to judge it within that prism as to whether it's good mainstream music or bad mainstream music. Although there obviously are some elements that I think we'll get into as we go track by track that are you know, very fucking weird. It's still a Bob Dylan show. You know?
It's 28 tracks. Actually, we've got it twice because this is two shows in their entirety with more or less the same set list, but punctuated by substitutions. So it's quite a clear narrative that Dylan wanted to tell, but some songs he regarded as expendable and replaceable with others from the catalogue. So
yeah, it's like if you go and see him now, like, it's mostly the same set list, but one night he'll cover fucking Billy Joel and the next night he'll cover like I don't know, just like Big Bill Broomsley or something.
Chuck Berry, he's touring America and playing a song written in the city that he's in.
He's not anymore, right, actually, because the New York Times blew his cover and he was like, oh, fuck this, now they've ruined the fun. So now it's anymore. Just same set list every night again.
still the great contrarian. As soon as you start enjoying it, he stops doing it. No one asks as much of their audience as Bob Dylan does, and no one gives as much to his audience as Bob Dylan does. So, I mean, maybe we should jump in. We're going to try and run through this entire set list, but rather than going song by song, we're going to group them and see what stood out to us as we go. So the first little group of songs would be A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, which acts as a kind of instrumental overture.
Then something he's periodically done in his career. I think even once or twice on the Rough and Rowdy Ways tour. Because he usually comes out to watching the river flow, doesn't he?
That's right.
And then I think one time he just let the band vamp on it. Just
when I was there at the Palladium, they came out and did a bit of noodling, and all the old guys in the denim waistcoats and Stetsons sat around me. All the old dudes were all arguing over which obscure early Dylan track that this was an instrumental version of. I think they were just having a bit of a noodle myself.
Yeah. Well, Stu Kimball, his guitarist from, I think, 04 to 2018, he was a very long-running member of Dylan's band. He used to do an acoustic guitar instrumental to start the show, and he'd sometimes work in little melodies, I think sometimes from older Dylan songs, often covers and stuff. But that was a central part of, well, central, it was right at the start. That was, that kicked off Dylan's shows for a good few years. So yeah, he's played with the idea of like an instrumental overture at several points in his career.
It's a reminder that Dylan is a great melodist, which isn't his reputation. I mean, these live albums remind us of Paul Williams' whole thesis that you've got to see Dylan as a performing artist, not as a writer primarily, even though he is that. The songs come alive in these varied and ever-shifting performances. But yeah, opening with an instrumental version of this early folk song, it reminds us that, okay, this is interesting music and melodically striking and inviting, even without its famous anti-nuclear war message.
Apocalyptic lyrics. I mean, he does that a lot on this record. He brings out the melodies of these old songs, generally with him singing the lyrics, but nonetheless, like, the songs that have lovely melodies in like 1965, like, by God, they sound beautiful here.
Absolutely right. So after that overture, we then get in the two shows two different 12-bar blues songs, one Repossession Blues, the other Love Her With a Feeling. Both of them great barroom jams, but not appearing on any record. These are the kinds of songs that Dylan sometimes does to get the band going. Sometimes it will be a cover of some obscure blues song. Sometimes it will be an almost improvised one that we then never hear again. But this is to kind of turn the band on and get them into the heat of performance.
Yeah.
Before Mr. Tambourine Man, I Threw It All Away, Shelter From the Storm, and Love Minus Zero, No Limit.
What can you say? Like,
that's the first six songs. You're seeing that. What are you going to be feeling, Jack, if you're sat there in Japan listening to that?
Euphoric, especially at those phenomenal renditions at both shows of Mr. Tambourine Man, which I kind of gave the game away talking about how he brings out the melodies in a lot of the songs here. And the same is also true for Love Minus Zero, No Limit. The flute, my God, the flute and the violin on these tracks, like, they show you, melodic depths to these songs that were previously uncharted. Like Mr. Tambourine Man, the obvious thing to do, I think this was the first time Dylan had, no, untrue, he'd done a full band arrangement with the band on the 1974 tour of Mr. Tambourine Man, just as like a one-off. It was like someone's birthday or something, and it had prominent accordion. My point is, it definitely didn't sound like the Byrds arrangement, which would be the obvious thing to do if you were doing a greatest hits show playing Mr. Tambourine Man with a full band. Instead of having the riff, and I apologize if I'm like hum and do Bob Dylan impressions at several points in this to illustrate my points.
I hope that by the end of it we're going to be doing full-throated renditions. We'll ease into this. We've got a long way to go.
But instead of that McGuinn riff, which I think just takes place over like two chords or something, the guitarist, I think Billy Cross is on lead guitar at these shows, just plays the riff on just on guitar, like ding. Mm-hmm. It, like he plays the vocal melody, ding ding dun 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 dun. Like it sounds. Is it like a kind of like a Caribbean sounding kind of ways playing? I don't know. It's definitely. There's a certain exoticism.
There's going to be both some national vagueness and some vagueness about technical musical vocabulary on this show, but we're going to do our best to describe what it is we're hearing on this thing.
Sounds wonderful anyway. And then Dylan comes in singing and his voice is just so strong. You know, it's not in the sense of his bellowing, like hyper macho vocal performances of 74 to 76, but it's a more nuanced style, but still very, very strong and powerful. More sensitivity, and yeah, he's staying fairly true to the original melodies on a lot of these tracks, although obviously the musical arrangement is completely different.
Is this a song you've got a big connection to?
Mr. Tambourine Man.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's one of my favorite Dylan songs. It's you know, it's just a lyrical masterpiece as well as just like a great work melodically, which Roger McGuinn obviously recognized when, you know, he arranged the Byrds version. Like, yeah, Mr. Tambourine Man, it's like, it's a psychedelic song that's just like two guitars on the original, you know? It's like, you don't need more than Dylan and that electric guitar noodling along, because like the lyrics are so fucking kaleidoscopic. They take you to like they take me to fucking new realms every time I hear it. So huge fan of Mr. Tambourine Man, and I love what he does with that. And no love minus zero, no limit here.
Yeah, that's a good pairing, and they're kind of from the transitional period. They're great songs from the transitional period that's taking him out of the early acoustic political material, but hasn't quite arrived in the heavy psychedelic blues electric period of the classic mid 60s period with the Hawks that then become the band.
They're both on Bring It All Back Home, aren't they? I think Love Minus Zero is on the electric side, and but I think he might play acoustic guitar on it. I think there is an electric guitarist, but you know, it's still, it's not like a rocking arrangement, but Mr. Tambourine Man, although it does feature an electric guitar. Yeah. That's on the acoustic side. So yeah, you're absolutely right there. That transitional period between the two Dylans.
Mr. Tambourine Man. I can't say it's a song that's ever been that important to me, but one of the things I love about these bootleg releases and these live releases is that if a song has somehow passed you by, a great and very widely admired, covered and famous song, if a song has passed you by, then this is your sort of chance to just hear it from a different angle or hear it anew. And I suppose I'd sort of written it off as just a kind of 60s LSD kind of museum piece in a way, but this huge soaring euphoric melodic version
that's absolutely the word I was going to use, euphoric,
carries it so far out of the acoustic original that the way that attempted to say the dignity of the song is that just the loveliness of the fact that it's Dylan soliciting the Tambourine Man to sing a song for him and to take him in all these places, describing his own slowness what is he saying? I'm not sleepy and there is no place I'm going to. He's
my
asking
weariness
to
amazes me.
My weariness, that's what
it's
I was
kind of contradicts that I'm not sleepy.
Exactly. So the lyrics are kind of caught between, on the one hand, weary, not sleepy, but possibly sleepy, and asking to be taken away and also being taken away. But that wonderful euphoric melody has already taken you away. If you see what I mean. I mean,
especially with the flute and that great lead guitar and that flute. It's flute season, folks.
You would not have expected the flute to be, you know, winning quite so much quite so early, but the flute is crucially important too.
Then Andre 3000 puts the flute down and he does the verse and it is so sick, and like obviously that doesn't happen.
That's followed by a couple of songs Well, I threw it all away in Shelter from the Storm. I threw it all away from the most country of the country period.
Lyrics records. Heavily rewritten.
Yeah. Beginning a habit. Well, not beginning a habit. He'd already done that on the Rolling Thunder review.
Exactly.
Rewriting. Rewriting. I threw it all away. With you. Yeah.
In 76 with new lyrics. But I think my theory with this is you'll notice he doesn't change the lyrics to Mr. Tambourine Man or Love mm-hmm. Minus Zero, No Limit. These 60s songs, he might change the music, but the lyrics are set in stone. And when I say 60s, I mean basically up to 1967. Because yeah. once you get to I'll Be Your Baby Tonight off of John Wesley Harding, he does not care about the original lyrics of that song. They change like virtually every year that he pulls it out. The same is true for I Threw It All Away. And I think it's because from 67 onwards, once he wasn't in that kind of like, I mean, obviously, as Dylan fans, we know he was doing great shit, especially in the basement tapes. That was like his most prolific period of songwriting ever. But he saw that as a new mode of songwriting from when just like, you know, Mr. Tambourine Man and like a Rolling Stone were pouring out of him, like in these bursts of inspiration. It became more of a craft to him at that point.
Yes.
And so in something like I Threw It All Away, you can do a kind of A-B substitution. Like the song, it's, and I don't mean this as a criticism because I like the song a lot, it's formulaic. And so you can say, but I must have been mad. I never knew what I had. Or you can say, but what did I do? I started looking at you. And it doesn't mm-hmm. really a kind of change the song. So Dylan does this a lot throughout his career. Then once you get to 67, there's loads of songs that there's a few at this show that I noted down, but that he pretty much they're continual works in progress to the present day, you know?
Yeah, that's right. And he's still doing that with similar songs. He's doing it yep. with
On Shadow Kingdom tonight,
and he's doing it to Be Alone With You.
On the current tour.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right about that, that those songs of the either side of 1970 kind of moment, they've always been important to his live shows. So it's like something about what he was doing right then has stayed with him as stuff he wants to bust out on stage, but they are available for that kind of switching out. And even that change to the lyrics of I Threw It All Away that you just quoted there, that shift from it being simply a song that's advising another man not to if you find someone who gives you all of her love, take it to your heart, don't let it fade, what did I do? I started looking at you. Turns it into a song that is at least momentarily addressed to another woman, the one who's ruined the relationship that the song's about. But even when I start thinking that, I feel like I'm getting kind of drawn into Dylan's trap and I'm thinking too hard about it. And actually, these lyrics may even be improvised in contrast to the ever-changing way that he performs the songs from Blood on the Tracks, where yeah. the changes to those lyrics are extremely artistically significant and show that these are almost kind of like folk songs in themselves, where they're retold and retold and the story is different every time.
Absolutely. So
different lyric changes have different levels of significance, I think, to Dylan's craft. Speaking of Blood on the Tracks, the next one is from there. It's not one with lyrical changes that I noticed, but no. rather
musical
changes. And the first time I spoke about Bob Dylan on this podcast was when I had Billy Childish, the great garage musician and artist, and he'd been recording some Dylan covers during lockdown. He said he'd never really listened to Dylan until he found on YouTube The Shelter from the Storm from this period. This like reggae version of Shelter from the Storm.
It's crazy.
And Billy Childish told me that this is what made it click for him, because he realized that this could be Joe Strummer. And I think that is not a bad comparison, actually, that this is sort of the Clash before the Clash, turning into this kind of call and response sort of reggae thing.
Yeah, Yeah, I'm just like I'm almost kind of like I sort of fucked up by I listened to a 1976 show just before doing. I was actually immediately before recording it. This I listened to about half the first the first show from the box set. So I have got some 78 fresh in my mind, but like I've kind of when I hear Shelter from the Storm now, I'm like hearing the crazy 1976 version with Dylan playing really really gnarly slide guitar. It's just like down where he's like suddenly I turned around and she was standing there like but this one, yeah, this is it's sort of reggae-ish. It's not the most reggae song on the record, but it's certainly got that groove to it.
Okay, we're making good headway. There's things I maybe want to say about some of these songs, but I'll come back to them in reference to other things. Let's keep driving forward. Our next block of six is Girl from the North Country, Ballad of a Thin Man, Maggie's Farm, To Ramona in the second show that is replaced with One More Cup of Coffee.
Good.
Like a Rolling Stone, and I Shall Be Released.
Not that I don't like To Ramona, by the way. I just fucking really like One More Cup of Coffee. So there's some crackers here. Like a Rolling Stone is my highlight of this batch of songs. Hang on, give me one sec.
Okay, excellent. The guitar is out.
yeah. Sorry, that was a momentary break while I got my guitar. But basically, like, so the original Like a Rolling Stone, it's like... It basically, if you have a keyboard, it's like the easiest thing to play because you just go literally up one chord, like with the same shape, and every fucking chord, it's like one. Once upon a time, you look so fine, fill the bums of time in your prime. Didn't you? I'll just play the first verse. People come and say, beware, dog. You're bound to fall, you thought they were all. Didn't you? So then he changes that. So he basically cuts out almost all the chords for the Budokan version. So it's just... Which of the two chords you hear on the intro of the original Like a Rolling Stone? So it becomes... Once upon a time you dressed so fine, threw the bums a dime in your prime, didn't you? So he also cuts out that pause before, didn't you? And he does that on the pre-chorus as well, where it's like instead of... You used to laugh about, he goes, you used to laugh about. And I love that. I love like the malleability of his songs, how you can change a few chords and it's still great, you know.
That's a wonderful demonstration of the musical difference. And I think that climbing chord structure of the original is very significant to the overall effect of the song. What one of Dylan's critics has remarked that although it's a masterpiece of vitriol and contempt, and it's part of a group of songs that are condemning the pride, the disease of conceit of the person being addressed, often the sort of the high class woman who thinks she's it, but the times they are changing and the sort of this kind of new wave of culture is coming in and the addressee is being left behind. At the same time, there's something too affirmative about the song for it only to be a bitter condemnation. That's where I think it's utterly different to Positively Fourth Street, a song that it would often be grouped with. And that's not only lyrical. I mean, it is lyrical in Like a Rolling Stone because, you know, you're becoming a Rolling Stone and that's freeing. Okay, it's humiliating to go from being at the top table to being now with the jokers and the clowns and the bums and so on. But you've been set free. And that ascending chord pattern accompanied with that message in the song is part of what makes it anthemic and a great kind of song of the free 60s, as opposed to just the sort of contemptuous insult that a cursory glance at the lyrics would have you think. And even though you've demonstrated that that isn't the musical structure of this version, I still think that it's retains some kind of muscle memory of that.
Oh yeah, and the chorus feeling. The chorus is exactly the same. The chords are the same. Billy Cross is playing the lead guitar parts from the original, which are like another quick demonstration. It's like,
please.
Something like that. And then it has the that's like the key lead guitar part. So he's doing like Mike Bloomfield worship on the chorus of that track. But then, so you actually combine like fan service with radical rearrangement on that. And then fucking hell, just again, to talk about the malleability of like a Rolling Stone using my guitar. When I saw him at Hyde Park in 2019, he had a completely new arrangement of like a Rolling Stone where the verses had the same chords as the original, not the chorus. And then he, like, the band dropped out and it went into something a bit like a kind of I Contain Multitudes, Murder Most Foul, drifting, floaty arrangement, or kind of like the version of Girl from the North Country in this batch of songs, which we'll talk about in a minute. But, you know, so it just became... ain't it hard when you discover that it really wasn't there it's at, or whatever, and then it just kind of built up, and then the chorus was like, the chorus had a new chord sequence. It was like, how does it feel? How does it feel to be on your own? Direction, and it's like it was different, but you could still sing along to it, and it reminded me a lot of this arrangement, even though, like I say, he changed completely different bits of the song.
That malleability and nonetheless the survival of this kind of core like affirmative quality, there is a case to be made that this is the greatest song of the 60s, maybe one of the greatest songs in pop music.
Yeah, I'd say a great, like, it's not like my personal favorite song, but I'd say there's a case to be made that it's the greatest song of all time.
That is part of the contrast for me with another song from the same record, Highway 61 Revisited, which appears in this cluster, Ballad of a Thin Man, which... in its original album performance, I think, is a masterpiece. In the other extant officially released version that we have on the 1966 erroneously titled Raw Albert Hall album, it is that version is indispensable also, yeah, with the Al Kooper organ going absolutely crazy on it. Those two are pretty definitive to me. Dylan has always seemed to like playing it and even played it this year. It doesn't fit and isn't in his regular Rough and Rowdy Ways tour set list. But when he appeared in a surprise cameo at Farm Aid in
the
summer...
With the Dirty Knobs, the classic, everyone, America's sweethearts, the Dirty Knobs.
It's they're like some of the surviving heartbreakers, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly.
Who so, played within the...
they are members of a beloved American band, at least a couple of them.
So he played Ballad of a Thin Man with them as well. But for me, that song should stay in the 60s. For me, that is a song that is triumphant when it is the sneering young man who's saying it. So in other words, it is the same voice who is speaking in Like a Rolling Stone. There, as in Positively Fourth Street, he's speaking contemptuously to a woman. In this one, he's speaking contemptuously to a bourgeois man, a man who...
boring, let's have more misogynistic abuse. Come on, that's what we want on left.
Yeah, no, well, I mean, there's a little bit of... queer baiting in this one, at least.
Oh, the sword swallower and all that,
So this guy who's being sneered at is...
Well, we know Dylan's views on Israel. Maybe it's like an attack on Owen Jones. He just anticipated it before, you know, he knew that this guy was going to cause trouble one day.
We know what Dylan's views on Israel were in one song anyway.
That's true. That is very true. I would like to think that he has undergone a journey since then.
So that song, Ballad of a Thin Man, yeah, okay. Well, so the bourgeois, the professional competence of having many contacts among the lumberjacks, you can hire people to do your labor for you. You've read through all F. Scott Fitzgerald's books. You're very well read. It's well known. You've got cultural capital that goes with your economic capital. But something is happening here, and you don't understand. That is one of Dylan's great rewrites, as far as I'm concerned, of the times they are changing. There, in that song, it's a message song, a universal song of one generation speaking to another. This song takes that into an individual, interpersonal relationship. So it's no longer simply that the times they are changing. It's something's happening here, and you don't know what it is. You try so hard, but you don't understand. That's the don't criticize what you can't understand from times they are changing. So it's doing something that Dylan does in this mid 60s period, where he doesn't simply reject and leave behind the early folk protest stuff. He sort of tells different stories with it, or he imputes more subjectivity to it and sees the human casualties, as it were, of the cultural changes that he's both living through and inaugurating. And I even think there's a tiny bit of sympathy that comes in here. Sympathy, if it only gets into like a Rolling Stone at the level of the chord sequence, it gets in here in something of the way that he performs it on the original studio recording.
I think Dylan himself has felt like he doesn't mm-hmm. know what's going on here, you know, at times. Even when he was younger, he sometimes felt like a man out of time. Even when he was the voice of a generation, he was like, hey, don't foist that on me. I don't have any more idea what's going on than you do.
The second, that's borne out in the second verses, sort of Alice in Wonderland like paradoxical nonsense that's being spoken to the guy in the song. Is this where it is? And somebody points to you and says it's his, and you say what's mine, and somebody else says, well, what is? And you say, you hear it, you can hear it in your head how Dylan sings it on the original recording, oh my god, am I here all alone?
That's
frustration, and this, who the hell are these people, what are they saying to me? Authority gone?
We'll maybe
he acts as the guy.
We'll maybe talk about Street Legal more in a minute when we get to mm-hmm. Is Your Love in Vain, but the final line on my album is another great like melodramatic Dylan moment where he's like, I can't believe it, I can't believe I'm alive. I love Street Legal. We'll have to get back to that in a second, but I'm gonna say totally agree with you on Ballad of a Thin Man in general.
Mm-hmm.
Actually really like this version.
You do.
I love the way that David Mansfield starts it off with just a bitchin' mandolin solo. Like, you don't get that on the original. It's cool. I mean, yeah, it's a fairly conservative performance. He's got a few new melodic elements, like the dun, it should be made to wear for earphones. Dun, dun, dun. No, wait, that's new. What is the new bit?
It's all in the back you'd sing is.
It's like the way it goes, just what you're gonna say when you get home. Exactly. It's the way they bring the backing singers out, and they have a more kind of like punchy, like
it's that it's a punchy kind of jazzy show tune. It's almost like, you know, Hamilton or something like that.
Yeah, so. I kind of like that though. It's like Bob and fucking like Tom Waits in the Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, like hamming it up.
Okay, you can save it that way. I find the mixture of contempt and sympathy in the studio version, the sheer contempt in the Albert Hall I don't believe you performance, those are so precious to me, and it makes me feel that as soon as you get out of the 60s, Dylan is no longer the kind of the cutting edge either voice of the generation or voice of the counterculture guy. He's a lonelier figure. And so who is he to speak with his contempt to Mr. Jones anymore?
1978, like he was Mr. Jones, basically.
Yeah.
I was listening to, it was the new episode of Never Ending Stories, the Dylan podcast, mm-hmm. where they were talking about like a show from 78 and comparing it to Budokan, like a show from later on in the tour. And the version of Ballad of a Thin Man that they played a brief clip of, like, I was gutted when they stopped the clip, because they played like Dylan's whole like mad rant about like meeting the Gypsy King or something at the start of it, and then he starts singing, and it's not like this is like the way he approaches it. Like I say, he's not doing the like 1976 style bellowing anymore on every song on this show. He just starts singing, "You walk into the room," but like but in this 78 show, he just like fucking lights into the vocal, like, "You walk into the room," like, and I need to track down that full performance, because it sounded like the most frighteningly intense Ballad of a Thin Man since probably 1966. Maggie's Farm, though, I think everything you say about Ballad of a Thin Man being kind of played out here, like Maggie's Farm, I don't give a fuck about this performance, really. Not very exciting.
Yeah, it's all a showcase for this sort of silly new riff.
It sounds like, is that it? It sounds very like 1976 tour, actually, like the kind of mad shit he'd play on slide guitar.
Yeah, it does. That said, and I note some of the reviews with Historical and Presence have singled out I Shall Be Released as one that especially suffers from these elaborate arrangements. I disagree, and I'll defend this arrangement.
I like it.
I think that this is one where if people are going to be precious about the authenticity of the basement tapes versions, I'm going to disagree. I guess the argument would be
that they're demos.
Taking this song, which is a kind of late example of Dylan's attachment to civil rights, this precious thing. He writes another Blowing in the Wind. Finally, in the late 60s, we can't sully this with this kind of Vegas presentation. I actually think that he turns it into something that could be on the Jackie Brown soundtrack.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is absolutely kind of black pride and black excellence
in this. Bob Dylan black excellence. I love that. Jay-Z did call himself the Bob Dylan of rap. But like a Rolling Stone, I mean, has a total, the new chord progression gives the version of Like a Rolling Stone a very gospel kind of period feeling here. So it is, a year before Dylan would go Christian. It's kind of although actually he'd start playing one of his Slow Train Coming songs on the 78 tour, presumably after that person threw the cross up onto the stage at him. But if that could have gone a whole different way, if the cross had just like smashed Dylan in the face and he just like had to go off stage and get like fucking surgery and he never became a Christian, like that's a real sliding doors moment.
It's tempting to think that the conversion is anticipated formally in the music in these shows,
musically,
Dylan learning to communicate and work with backing gospel singers.
That's true. Dylan, this is the first time that he'd used female backing singers in a live context. Obviously, like Joan Baez doesn't count because she's a duet partner rather than a backing singer. And he'd used it, he had female singers on Self-Portrait, and he had Emmylou Harris on Desire. But live, it had always been just a bloke bellowing along to him, generally on Rob Stoner or Rick Danko, the bassist. So
the backing singers and the conversion of originally kind of white arrangements rearranged into pure soul songs, I Shall Be Released, and we'll get to You're a Big Girl Now. It's almost as if even before the cross arrives on stage and he starts thinking about Christianity, the music has already kind of got there one step ahead of him. Well, you mentioned Girl from the North Country, but I don't have that much to say about it, except that it's a lovely moment.
It's beautiful. It's
one of those that drops everything back and just lets the voice present.
Yeah, it's just like basically Dylan on guitar, Alan Pasqua on organ, and what's his name? Steve Souls? Or, no, he was one of the guitarists. I forget. Steve Douglas, I think, on sax. And... Dylan's lead guitar playing on Girl from the North Country, very good. He plays a guitar solo on both renditions of the song. I didn't notice any bomb notes. He's kind of sliding up a scale, but it's like very competent playing for Bob Dylan. He does generally, you know, when Bob Dylan's playing, you can like work out, okay, that guitar is Bob, by like someone starts playing a guitar solo that is like not of a professional standard. And there's a couple of moments here on I Threw It All Away, Bob starts soloing, and you can, you're like, okay, that's where they've mixed his guitar.
It's really one of the endearing things about him.
There's the
great master.
That video of him
is an okay guitarist.
Yeah, exactly. There's that video of him in the 90s where Eric Clapton brings Dylan on stage at a big Madison Square Garden show he did. They do a bunch of songs together and Dylan just solos throughout the entirety of every song. Clapton just has no space to come in. Good shit. I was just going to say, on the I Shall Be Released gospel connection, there is an absolutely insane version of that song from 1986, I think. Dylan performed it with Stevie Wonder's backing band at some like civil rights, 20 years since the civil rights struggle telethon or something. And it has like new lyrics about like being in the arms of another man's wife, which is like, what the fuck has that got to do with anything? But yeah, so he has actually rewritten the lyrics to I Shall Be Released in other instances. He did not do that at Budokan.
Wow. well, we're charging through this. This is great. The next block we have.
Before we get onto that, should we mention one more cup of coffee?
Oh Christ, yeah, from the second performance. So exactly. We To Ramona is correctly replaced with One More Cup of Coffee. Yes, good. So this is from Desire.
Kind of disco arrangement.
Yeah. And am I right in thinking this is apart from those disco-ish flutes that we've spoken about before, this is the first one where disco rhythms start to enter into the instrumentation.
Maybe I'm looking up at the others and I think possibly that is the case. I've just gone back to just noticed Repossession Blues. I just want to say, enjoyed that more than Love Her With a Feeling as the blues cover as second song. I like the mid-tempo thing more as kind of a new pony sort of vibe. Again, tipping our hat towards Street Legal. One more cup of coffee here is great, but like, again, to get the guitar out and demonstrate, like,
yeah,
so the original, I love the sort of vocal histrionics of Dylan's original take of that song and certain live performances on I don't know if he did it in 76, he definitely did in 75, but it's like, your breath is sweet, your eyes are like. So it's like got this proper like very kind of wailing like he'll like, I fucked that up there, but he'll like stretch one syllable out into like several syllables, you know. Your daddy, he is an outlaw and a wanderer by trade. So it's not just outlaw, it's outlaw, ho, ho, ho. And here it's just, your breath is sweet, your eyes are like two jewels in the sky. Your back is straight, your hair is smooth on the pillow where you lie. So he just kind of, he does a more subtle kind of vocal performance. So I missed those histrionics, what I believe Allen Ginsberg described in the liner notes of Desire as Hebraic cantillations. But but I felt that the kind of the mad like gypsy disco Desire thing, I felt that compensated for a more restrained vocal from Dylan.
yeah it's great. And I mean, it reminds us that on Dylan's radio show, Theme Time Radio Hour, there is a whole episode dedicated to songs about coffee.
Nice.
Which brings out something of the back history I don't know, the cup of coffee as extending time somehow. I remember one song that he plays on that show is Otis Redding's cigarettes and coffee, where it's got to be a unique song about staying up all night, but not from drugs or alcohol, but well, only from caffeine and nicotine. And there, the being present with the woman is extended into the early hours by having one more cigarette, one more cup of coffee. Dylan's one more cup of coffee. I don't know. I'm thinking here of Love Minus Zero, No Limits, which I gather in one live performance, Dylan said that that title has to be understood like a mathematical fraction, love minus zero over over the words No Limit.
Damn, he needs to get on Genius, to formerly Rap Genius, and do like those verified annotations on there. It's like, this is what I meant all along.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, some of our listeners will think of the kinds of algorithms of desire Jacques Lacan was drawing up on the blackboard at the same time as Dylan's own algorithm of desire in Love Minus Zero, No Limit. But
sorry, the only desire-related Jacques I recognize is Jacques Levy.
Yeah. So lyricist, of course. But yeah, the one more cup of coffee. I don't know. It's a surprising song to find included in this Vegas showcase.
One of two Desire songs, I think, featured in the run of shows.
Okay, yeah. Oh Sister's going to be the other one.
Yeah, and that is also kind of disco-fied.
Yeah, so songs that Desire, what can we say here? I mean, this will take us into the next block, which has the sole representative of Dylan's new album, of his present album, Is Your Love in Vain, from Street Legal.
But before we get to that, were you going to say something prior to...
I was going to say something about Desire, though. In contrast to the short shrift that Street Legal gets here, Dylan's previous big tour, the Rolling Thunder Review, had been an exercise in kind of taking the aesthetic and the instrumentation and the spirit of Desire, this album of songs co-written with a dramatist. They're all kind of ballad-like story songs about some strange, vagabondish character or outsider, or they are, as in the Hebraic, yodeling or whatever it was.
Cantillations. Is that a word? I don't know, but it's what Ginsberg wrote.
I mean, I'm thinking of Hot Chili Peppers in the Blistering Sun. And Romance in Durango. So songs that are built around a kind of a sort of sound, a marketplace in some country or other kind of aesthetic. So the album is built around its gypsy fiddle playing, and then the tour gets built around the album.
By the way, Scarlett Rivera, not a real gypsy from what I've heard. She like made up her Roma heritage. You can cut that out if it's not true.
But no, well, I mean, it fits because, didn't Dylan at some point claim to be Native American as opposed to Jewish when he was young?
Fantastic.
We've all romanticized our backgrounds one way or another. So to find those Desire songs here, transported from this kind of performance of organicism, this performance of this kind of campfire or marketplace, impersonal singing, transported here to the most alienated capitalist uptight machined arrangements and presented in this kind of Vegas disco style, is itself a kind of interesting process or gesture.
Yeah.
Are we ready to get into the one appearance of a Street Legal song?
Well, I was going to say just before that, we should mention Bob's stage banter in the first show following Like a Rolling Stone and just before I Shall Be Released. He goes, "Thank you. It must sound better out there than it does up here."
He's in a lull in this mid-set part.
He sounds legit depressed when he says it. And then he goes into I Shall Be Released and he sounds really sad.
He sounds sad there. And then he plays Is Your Love in Vain. And I think it's a wonderful performance.
And
he says after it, you might recognize the next one more or something. He's again apologetic or dismissive
and before launching into... Like...
Going, Going, Gone.
Yeah, yeah, a fairly obscure song.
From Planet Waves with totally different lyrics and a different melody as well. Yeah, so yeah. They're not going to know that, Bob.
So good, so good. I love that. Yeah, this is like, we're probably getting to my favourite stretch of the show, at least since the opening of Mr. Tambourine Man and Love Minus Zero. I'm just looking for the set list again real quick. Yeah, Is Your Love in Vain? I mean, this is one of the songs I love. Like, is this the one that, like, the review at the time by, like, Grail Marcus said that he sounded like a fucking, like, syphilitic Saudi prince calling on his, calling on his, like, sex slave to come and suck him off, some shit like that. It's a very, like, imaginative description of Dylan's posture in this song.
Well, Dylan standing on the cover of Street Legal, I mean, it's an unusually literal Bob Dylan cover in that he's standing on a street.
presumably legally.
Wearing some quite unflattering baggy jeans.
And I just want to say,
interpretation of the song, I wonder if that's giving a bit of sex tourist, whereas in Desire, he fitted right in these various kind of ethnic environs that he was performing in.
Yeah,
seems a bit out of place on the cover of Street Legal.
Speaking of Dylan in unflattering garb, I actually have a poster from the vinyl copy of this album of him in that all-white suit up on my wall in my room. Mm-hmm. That's my Dylan poster. Like, I don't have one of him in a period where he looked cool. Like, that does the trick for me, that one.
Yeah, well, we're all just waiting to catch up with Dylan's fashion choices. They all have their moment in the end.
Exactly. But Street Legal. What were you going to say? Okay. Sorry.
Street Legal, that is one that people have been waiting for. And maybe this release will have the sort of the Dylan message boards groaning a bit, because they've been crying out for a 1978 Dylan bootleg series. Mm. We don't want more blood on the tracks. We don't want more Christian stuff. We want Street Legal. It's one that... is one that I never bought in Soundhouse in Broadstairs as a teenager. It's one that I only listened to much, much later. It's kind of under the radar for a lot of people, I think. But it's one that has both a huge standing among the real heads and also is very, very, very well regarded by this new kind of Zoomer Dylan audience that I was referring to before. The Jokermen guys... put a lot of emphasis on Street Legal,
absolutely,
as well. And I think rightly, it's a wonderful album.
I've been on that Jokerman mindset, but since before there was a Jokerman, like too many mans in that sentence. But
that's the true 70s trilogy: Blood on the Tracks, Desire, Street Legal. However sort of good the ones before that are, Planet Waves, I don't think is as major or complete a work, however wonderful it is, as Street Legal is. Even
he does
if it
do
is,
the best song from it on this show, though.
Yeah, you he does. You think is Your Love in Vain the best song?
Oh, sorry, I meant Planet Waves. He does
Planet Waves,
Gone, which is fantastic song, I think. Although, like you say, this is not your daddy's going is it? Street Legal, I might as well address this. Like, I actually, it's not one, like, a lot of Dylan albums I got into through just going through my dad's CD collection. Mm-hmm. He had a lot of them. Street Legal was not one of them. I got into it probably, like, concurrently with the Jokermen guys, because I remember when they reviewed it originally, they didn't really like it. And I listened to that and I was like, yeah, this one's not very good, is it? And then I I guess I just needed that fix. So I was like, okay, what Dylan album do I try and get into now? And Street Legal now, a few months ago, I put together a list of my favorite albums of 1978, because, you know, most of my favorite music did come out like 15 to 20 years before I was born. But like, this album was my second on that list after Bruce Springsteen's Darkness on the Edge of Town. I think it's an amazing album. It's got like songs like Changing of the Guards, Signor Tales of Yankee Power, Where Are You Tonight, Journey Through Dark Heat, like a couple of amazing parentheses there. My favorite, True Love Tends to Forget, which it amazes me has not been turned into a standard by now. I don't know if like Adele's producers just haven't heard it, like they got their hands on that later track instead, but oh my God, amazing song, man. Don't Keep Me Knocking Around from Mexico to Tibet. Like everything he rhymes with forget in that song is unbelievable. And I quoted Where Are You Tonight's Journey Through Dark Heat earlier with the I Can't Believe It, I Can't Believe I'm Alive line that concludes it, although he says after that, but without you, it doesn't feel right, which just shows the kind of heartbroken place he was in at this time in his life. But yep, fucking love Street Legal, man. Are you a fan now? Has it grown on you?
Absolutely, yeah. I think for me, it's the fact that it's truly a song cycle in the same way that Blood on the Tracks and Desire are. I mean, okay, Changing the Guards, you plucked that out as I think it was on one of the it was on the Essential Bob Dylan compilation I had, and I think at the time I thought that sort of, you know, we've got a flatter Bob that there's always a good song on an album, so there has to be something from every album on here. But no, that is a great Dylan song, but it's not so great that it exists autonomously or separately from the rest of it. If Blood on the Tracks is a great example that however much you might love individual songs, they come alive and they make most sense as this sort of this broken mirror of just seeing a relationship or a feeling about relationships from these different angles of stepping into the shoes of different people, all of them involved in heartbreak in some way. Desire has that aesthetic consistency that I described before. And then Street Legal is, you know, the new pony, that kind of
pony that I'm gonna fuck. He is basically the
one of the greatest. That is his equus. the as slight and stupid a song as it appears to be, that kind of that distance from the breakup. This is very much kind of a post Blood on the Tracks feeling world where you've been slightly coarsened by a breakup. You've had the sensitive edges of what you're capable of feeling in love filed down, and you're a bit more of a wounded, blunted person. And that is there at the level of instrumentation, those parping 70s saxophones that are all over it, the slightly more processed studio style and arrangements of that record, especially compared to Desire. It fits with the slightly manufactured, alienated world of the instrumentation of this gig. So maybe there is more of a connection between Street Legal and this live album than he hadn't recorded it
yet. Like I assume, I think he wrote a lot of the songs throughout 77, but I assume that at this point he hadn't really taught the band most of the songs. I think they rehearsed a couple. So I sent you a list of songs that they rehearsed for the shows but didn't perform. And there were a couple of unreleased, a couple of Dylan originals that are unreleased to this day. I think he might have co-written them with his backing singer, Helena Springs, who he was co-writing a bit of stuff.
So presumably we're waiting for the bootleg series of Street Legal that will
give us those. Certainly am.
We hope so.
Yeah, because there's some great... I mean, what I want to hear is bringing up my man Eric Clapton again, who I'm now back in like contrarian Clapton defender mode, sort of, because because he backed a ceasefire.
He's pro Gaza and pro RFK Jr. So
the
popular show audience is a bit confused, but that's how we like to feel about gigs. Now that he's backed the ceasefire, he's finally crossed the line from dickhead to prospective popular show guests. As long as two in five opinions only are completely insupportable and disgusting, then he's our kind of guy.
but he put out an album in 1978 called Backless, which should be called Spineless. It's like the most kind of like soft middle of the road album. I actually like it because of how mediocre it is. I put it on, I'm astonished by how like perfectly like in the center of music this record is. But it contains two Dylan originals, I think both co-written with Helena Springs, that were never recorded by Dylan to our knowledge. I really want to hear a Dylan version of the song that opens that record, Walk Out in the Rain, which I think is a really good song. It just has the most lackluster vocal performance by Clapton that I've ever heard. Like, he sounds, I mean, even by Clapton standards, he sounds asleep on the performance. But I like the song a lot. I mean, Dylan could have got Clapton to play guitar on it, I guess. Like, the song's got a nice guitar. So, I want to hear that. But there's also, there's a ballad called Coming From the Heart, which sounds like a pretty good song. There's like a bad quality live version and a good quality rehearsal version that there's only about a minute of. And there's a song called Stop Now, which is just kind of a blues jam. Like, Bob literally could have made it up on the spot, you know?
It's fascinating. I had no idea about this. So we've got a very strange situation where Clapton is being allowed to be the kind of the archive for a not unreasonable number of Bob Dylan songs from this moment.
Oh, yeah.
This is also the moment when Rock Against Racism is really starting up in the UK, specifically in reaction to Clapton's pissed up racist remarks on stage.
Yeah, I'm not defending that aspect of his oeuvre, I just want to say.
Well, no, I'm there for the good songs that he played badly, that Bob Dylan wrote. Not for the racism. But
actually, Clapton's previous album, No Reason to Cry, also has a Dylan original that Dylan just donated to him. And that album, basically, it's like Clapton and the band on the whole record for the most part. But Dylan gave him a song called Sign Language, which he sings. The full song is a duet between Dylan and Clapton. They're singing together the whole time, and the lyrics are like, "You speak to me in sign language while I'm eating a sandwich."
Are you serious?
It's so fucking good. Yeah, like I say, I like to dig deep with this stuff. Oh, and also on the rehearsals note, they also rehearsed We'd Better Talk This Over, the song from Street Legal, which is another highlight for me, very groovy kind of song.
That's a wonderful song.
But yeah, we can move on. Those are the like new songs that they rehearsed but did not perform at this show.
I've got more to say on Is Your Love in Vain, and I think we're going to come back to Clapton a little later on. But
great.
I'm going to announce that we are now departing the freeloader zone and entering the free speech zone over at patreon.com/thepopularpod. We've still got a fair bit of this record to go. And if you want to truly understand this important document, you're going to have to follow us over there. Jack, I hope you're happy to stick around for a bit longer while we cover the rest of this record.
Absolutely. I'm all in, to the bitter end.
patreon.com/thepopularpod. You listeners, get over there right now.
Do it.